All right, the two changes, Judge Davis, I think, alluded to one of them. The Chief Justice, by amendment in 1970, is now selected from the vote amongst the justices, and he has a 3-year term and can't have two consecutive terms. That's an interesting story in itself. No matter what you put in the Constitution, the success or failure of the system depends on the personalities, the quality of the people you get, their goodwill, energy, and talent. Directly attributable to a marvelous story that led to the reform, and a tragic story for one justice on the Supreme Court. The other reform was, I think the bar thought that there was too close a relationship between the Chief Justice and the Administrative Director, who has a statewide administrative control. And there, instead of having, again, a constitutional amendment, the Administrative Director serves at the pleasure of the court, not the Chief Justice. Both amendments were aimed at tyranny or abuse of power. As one justice said, power is very heady stuff, and experience proved it. And these were explicit checks put in our Constitution to break what I think the bar and probably a significant segment of our population thought was an abuse of power. Now, and one last comment. Although we have this apolitical merit selection system, I think our Chairman Kleinfeld's remarks point up a very difficult problem we have in the judiciary. Alaska has been economically very strong for attorneys, at least ever since I've been here in the 4th Judicial District. We've been in a boom economy, and lawyers in private practice have had, those who are willing to work and have more than modicum of talent, have been very successful. And we have been, I would say, less than successful in attracting to the judiciary the private practitioner who has really made it economically. And we still can't do it, although we have, I think, an excellent retirement program for judges, and the salary, although we have runaway inflation here, is adequate. And that is one of the problem of knocking public service, thinking that you're just living off the public trough, and then the very lucrative private practice. This is not to say that, you know, some people prefer the problems of private practice over the judiciary. And one other thing I would suggest to Judge Davis, we are hardly an unnoticed branch. I think despite the independence that is theoretically built in to this document for judges, once they are appointed, our judges are under tremendous attack in Anchorage from the most powerful paper in the state. I think it's, for the most part, a reckless, unthinking attack. But I know a judge who sits day to day can't be immune from this attack, and it's showing in sentencing patterns and the psychological impact on certain judges. With that, I can.
Justice Rabinowitz, I wonder, you mentioned that there was a marvelous story behind that constitutional amendment that changed the method of selection of the Chief Justice, but you didn't tell the story.
That's right, because I don't want this to generate into an anecdotal session, but if you want to do it during the coffee break, fine. Or maybe Judge Buckaloo or one of the others want to tell it. The details, it was quite a struggle between the bar and the bench, and had tragic results for one justice on the court. Oh, I understand it's a coffee break. Are you going to go right through?
What is the structure that we just
I think a lot of people actually got coffee while the tape was being changed. Do people feel like taking a break, or should we go on with the discussion?
I
wonder if Millard Ingram could comment now. Millard has been a participant in the activities of the bar. He's been president of the state bar, and I think would be in a particularly good position to comment on some of the history, particularly the bar fight, which I think is the story that Justice Rabinowitz was alluding to, and some of the other issues that have arisen in application of our Constitution on the judiciary.
Thank you. I never really got a firm fix on what the structure of this panel was. Maybe other people on the panel did. So I'm a little bit at a disadvantage. I would agree with Judge Davis's opening comment that if, of course, had nothing to do with the drafting of this article, but if I were to redraft it today, at least as far as I know, I don't think there are any changes in it that I would make. I think it's still probably a model for every other state that's trying to reform their judiciary. Do you think I should? I don't really think that the bar fight has much to do with this article. I'd be glad to talk about it, but that's what I said. I thought that we're supposed to concentrate on this article more.
Go ahead and use your judgment.
Okay. I think, and everything I think has probably already been covered. I think that the leading point of this whole article is the unified judiciary. It's already been pointed out. There's only one court system. There's only one superior court, which brings up something that is being discussed now. It does say that superior court shall be the trial court a general jurisdiction. It also somewhere else says that the legislature may fix other courts. Now, there has been some talk now of just making all the trial courts superior courts. In the Bush areas, which has been discussed, I think it's probably true that the superior court judge isn't needed. If the superior court judge just does the functions that superior courts do in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau. Like even in Nome, I was city attorney for Nome for 3 years. There's no real reason to have a superior court judge in Nome if he only does the function of the superior court. If he did the function of the superior court and the district court, I think there maybe could be. For those who aren't familiar with the court system.
I just wanted to ask one question. I don't, with a unified court system, you got a judge in Nome that's only required judicial activities that normally require 5 days a month. With a unified court system, the Chief Justice is directed to come to Fairbanks and Anchorage. The same way with a judge at Kodiak or Bethel.
No.
So there shouldn't be any way.
No question about it, except I'm a taxpayer and I don't particularly like to pay these plane fares. Per diem, hotel bill, things like that. It's extremely expensive. I don't know what the judges get per diem, but if you're going to have a judge living in Nome, he's going to be spending 90% of his time in Anchorage. He ought to be in Anchorage.
They get $45 a day.
Well, but if... Okay. But that's my feeling. The only way I would ever justify keeping a judge in Bethel or anything like that is if they also did the work at a district court, which handles misdemeanors and civil matters of under $10,000.
Well, I should say that's what they're precisely what
right.
They're doing.
That's well, Kodiak. I'm not arguing with you. I'm trying to agree with you. That was, but I got interrupted by the question. Okay, but yeah, that is what they're doing. Except for those who are not familiar with the court system, the district court handles misdemeanors, and this is the metropolitan area, misdemeanors and civil matters involving sums less than $10,000, and I think there's a few other restrictions, such as they can't handle matters involving titles to real property and perhaps a few others, but the main ones are they only have misdemeanors in criminal law and civil matters under $10,000. And so I'd agree both with what Judge Davis said and Justice Rabinowitz said, that and so far as the Bush areas go, I don't think that the Superior Court judges, they only did the work of Superior Court judges in metropolitan areas would be justified in Bethel or even Nome or Sitka or any of those places. If you did combine them with the functions of the district court judge, I think it might work. If we could get enough qualified people, Andy Kleinfeld and I talked about this the other night, It might even be good to combine them, I think, in the larger areas and just split the court up into divisions. Take the younger judges and they say put them in a misdemeanor division or the small civil case division that gives the court more flexibility. I know oftentimes here in Fairbanks, both our district court and our superior court are overloaded. But oftentimes you can't get a judge in superior court because of a lot of cases folding. There'll be a couple of judges sitting around drinking coffee in the district court. But you can't jerk them from the district court up to the superior court to hear matters that perhaps are very important and need to be heard right away to protect the rights of the litigants. This is only kind of conjectural. I don't know if it's ever been discussed, and I don't know whether it even worked. And we do have enough problems getting anybody to be qualified, any qualified people to apply for Superior Court if you made all the trial court positions Superior Court judges. I don't know if that would work. But certainly, I think in the Bush areas, you can justify Superior Court if they also handle the district court functions. And it would even be economical. Like in Nome, when I was city attorney there, they had a magistrate, they had a district court judge, and they had a superior court judge. One judge, you know, could have done all those functions in Nome. And they had three judges. On the Missouri plan, I do favor that. I think that's a very good way. I sort of question whether the election or retention election, I guess they call it, really serves any useful function. The only judge that has been defeated was Justice Aaron, and that was very much involved in a highly political controversy between the bench and the bar, which I said I don't really want to get into. Other than that, I'm not sure it really serves any function to even have it. There is another body which has risen through the legislature, which is not mentioned in this article at all. And Andy Kleinfeld and I, when we tried to have sort of a discussion about what we're going to do here, discussed it. Maybe it should be incorporated into the judiciary article, and that is the Judicial Qualifications Commission. Where is it? Where? Oh, all right, yeah, okay, I see it is in there. And that maybe could take the place of the retention election, which doesn't really seem to do much good, being people, the judges usually just get elected unless they're involved in a political controversy. And that's something where you, where if a judge is really unqualified, then this commission which is set up will pass on his qualifications and he will be removed. In the federal system, if you're appointed, you're appointed for life. And there was a book out called The Benchwarmers recently, and they point out there's been a lot of abuses of the federal judiciary. I mean, very incompetent people, maybe even mentally incompetent people, had remained on the federal judiciary because the appointment for life. But I think, like Andy pointed out when we were discussing it, the conclusion of the book is that that's the price you pay, and it's better to have it that way and have them independent than having to kowtow to politicians all the time. The Judicial Council is in there. I think that has really functioned well in this state. I know when I first came, this is shortly after statehood, and there was a lot of people who were speculating that it would not function well, that we would not get qualified judges through it, that politics would run rampant, that people would be more like blackballing qualified people for political reasons, or they would be pushing unqualified people for political reasons. But I don't think that happened. As I can't think, since I've been here, in a way, of any time that politics has really influenced the Judicial Council very much. I know during Democratic administrations, Republican judges have been appointed. During Republican administrations, Democratic judges have been appointed. And I think everyone who's gotten through the Judicial Council and gone to the governor for appointment has been qualified. Don't think any unqualified judge has been elected. So I think it's all worked very well. The rulemaking power, Justice Benowitz commented on that, and I agree with that. I think that is very good. And I think it's also good that the Constitution provides that the legislature can, by a two-thirds majority, overrule a rule. This keeps the court in check somewhat. Just because we're dealing with judiciary, we don't want to forget that judges are human beings and subject to the same weaknesses that other human beings are, and they could start passing rules that would be really against the interests of the people. And if that happens, the Constitution does provide that two-thirds vote of the legislature can override their rules, which is good. One of the amendments that's been commented, which I think is particularly important, is rotating the Chief Justice. When the court system was first set up, there was just one Chief Justice, and presumably once you were Chief Justice, unless you voluntarily resigned from that position, you would be Chief Justice as long as you remained on the court, which presumably would be for the life of your career. And that was changed to make that into a revolving Chief Justice. As I understand the way it works now is what the court elects the Chief Justice, right? And it rotates how often? Every 3 years?
Every 3 years, and you have two consecutive terms.
Right. And the good thing of that, of course, is, you know, like somebody said, justice is power is a very heady thing, and this keeps you from getting power for too long. Maybe the bad thing would be that it doesn't allow any one person a chance to really form his court, like in the federal system we have. You know, we speak of the Warren Court and the Burger Court and things such as that. It's very difficult to anymore, I think, in the Supreme Court to speak of a Rabinowitz Court or a Boutchever Court because it's only 3 years. We did have the Nesbitt Court and the Boney Court, but I think now it would be very difficult to get that kind of fix on it, and maybe that's good and maybe it's bad. It's certainly more of a democratic thing now. I think it's something that should be thought about and should be discussed. Also, the administration of the court used to serve at the pleasure of the Chief Justice only. Now it serves at the pleasure of the entire court. I don't know how that works. If you don't like the administrator, what do? Take a vote?
It would have to be a majority vote. The theory there was we ought to professionalize it, not make it a very subservient position to the Chief Justice and a very personal relationship to the Chief Justice, but serve the entire court system, the entire Supreme Court.
Okay, that sounds good. The only bad thing I can think about that, as Andy and I were talking about, is it probably does tend to create an independent bureaucracy, and I generally dislike bureaucracies. And I think that you know, maybe the bureaucracy tends to grow more and become completely independent and sort of self-perpetuating, because they don't have to answer to any one person. When you only have to answer to a body, it's a little easier to get by with sloppy stuff and hire more assistants and more secretaries and things such as that. But those in general are my...
There's a question on that.
I'm not the one to answer that. I think probably Justice Benowitz would be the one who would be most appropriate to answer that, having served as Chief Justice. I've never been a judge, so I don't know.
Well,
but that's the last of my comments anyway.
He's got to prepare the budget for the court system. They're now up to about $15 million, most of which pays for these fancy courthouses that they alluded to. I'd like to tell you a comment about that. You know where the market basket is, East Highway? Well, we had such humble origins that there was a proposal in 1959 to put the Supreme Court over Market Basket. I think we moved in the right direction other than going to Market Basket.
Yeah, there was also a bowling alley there at the time, but it was one of the three sites proposed. And a lot of people thought it might be neat because then you're bored in your practice, or you know you got a break in your court, you can go down and bowl a couple of blocks.
Oh, it just shows you, though, that many people didn't realize the importance of these. Anyhow, he prepares the budget. He has to take care of the facilities, that is, when we have adequate courthouses, get the bonding for it, legislation. He's our lobbyist for the legislature. He's got to take care of all the physical needs of the court system. Got to make sure the jurors are paid. In short, everything else, aside from what goes on in the courtroom, theoretically within control of the administrative director, subject to the Supreme Court. And I might say, in my own experience, making him responsible to a small body, five men, has, I think, professionalized the position, and the administrative director now can call him really as he sees him, without the subservient attitude to one man. If he crosses the Chief Justice, he was out in the old days. And I think it's made him much more independent and much more professional. Well, this one, our present, most of our administrative directors in the history of the court system since David have been lawyers. Everything's changed throughout the country. We now have schools that teach administrators, calendaring, financing, equipment, courthouse planning. So they are getting the training, and our present administrative director was a trial court administrator in a large county in Maryland. So he did come with prior experience. He's been with us about 3 years.
Justice Rabinowitz, there's been some comments that you occasionally hear in the bar that the administrative office used to do very little. It was just a few cronies of the chief, but there were only a few of them. Very little salary burden, very little interference in the business of the court. Now they're professionals, there are a tremendous number of them, all with numerous secretaries and assistants, and not much work to do, so that they continue to interfere and intervene, send out questionnaires, send out forms to be filled out, and impose a whole lot of work and unnecessary change.
May I intervene? When I was talking about bureaucracy, court bureaucracy, I was not talking about the administrative director. I think this one and previously, I think have done an excellent job, and I certainly wasn't talking about them.
Well, I think I stated the part of the anti-view, and I'm sure that Justice Rabinowitz would like to respond to it.
Well, you know, lawyers like to talk, and some in private practice have less than a lot of time and it's noise about the office. They like to gossip. Sure. And I think it's an echo of our frontier, and underpopulated, very slow, very familiar, very warm type of judicial service we could render in late territorial days and very early stages of the court system. I don't usually agree with Chief Justice Berger, but no longer can any court system run in Abe Lincoln's days, horse and buggy days. And yes, you do get questionnaires, and you do get so-called administrative interference. They want to know how the system's operating, what lawyers think. They want to know their changes. As for these allegations of vast staff, I imagine they're now for a $16 million operation. We have 8 people on Office Stoden's staff. Well, make your own decision there. I'm not counting the secretaries. I'm counting the 8 major people.
There have to be some more people in those 5 floors in Anchorage.
Yes, unfortunately we have it with trial judges. We have it the library space takes 2, clerk of court's offices. And the Supreme Court, I'll make a confession, mea culpa, is the only branch, only division within the court system that has an overabundance of space. And that's all. I don't think the trial courts have too much space there. In fact, they're short courtroom space. It's very easy, and this is coming from a lawyer's attitude to take a negative attitude. I don't think it's empire building. We shouldn't be over market baskets. I think people, jurors as well as witnesses and litigants, are entitled to decent, comfortable surroundings. A judge who spends the major time of his life doesn't have to work in the functional slum I do in Fairbanks. He's entitled to a place where he doesn't have to hear a toilet flush before it rows down. This is actually what happened. This is a change. If you want the log cabin justice finance, the change has come.
Could I ask one question? When this Constitution was written, the judicial article, I don't think it ever occurred to the delegates that the Supreme Court would be split, that is, one justice in Anchorage one in Juneau and one in Fairbanks. It's obvious judicial ways. It's an enormous burden on travel, per diem, and so forth. And I wrote the Chief Justice a letter and advised him that in my opinion that was not what the founding fathers had in mind. And
That's an excellent point. For the students, the judiciary article is silent on where the Supreme Court should sit. And right from the inception of the court system, the court has been split, with the justice sitting in one in Anchorage and then two in Juneau. Then we had a quick resignation and the replacement, Justice Aaron sat in Fairbanks. That geographical split has been maintained. The Supreme Court even promulgated the rules. It's up to the individual justice to decide where he should sit. This is an ongoing problem. I think with the workload, with all the deference to the Fairbanks Bar, travel is killing us, and that the major workload comes from Anchorage, is generated there. More than 80% of our work is there, and it doesn't make sense from my point of view to be split anymore geographically. This again is a political compromise shaping the court system, just like we have with our judicial districts that are in the hands of the legislature.
I'd like to, Ed, do you remember? That was my understanding, but I remember we talked about it at the convention.
Oh, I think we assumed that the Supreme Court was going to sit
in June
in the Capitol. I think so. But Jay is absolutely correct. There isn't any excuse for the Supreme Court in Juneau. That isn't what they do. Their work. Their work is in Anchorage.
Well, isn't that kind of the same thing we're talking about before with the Superior Court? I mean, we can talk, you mentioned a lot of populations, say, in the Bethel area, but there really is no judicial business in Bethel, is there?
Well,
on a Superior Court level.
Unless the judges are misleading me, I've talked to two judges who've had really long experience, and maybe you sat out there, Judge Buckley, Judge Lewis, and now Judge Hanson. And they say the work is there if you combine Superior and District Court jurisdiction and are not afraid to get out and service some of the communities from Bethel. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to travel, you can keep yourself more than occupied. And I think this...
Now, if you hear the misdemeanor...
Yeah, and also, you know, Judge Davis has said, and, you know, I don't know whether I'm right or Judge Davis is right, but I think you ought to have the tension of different viewpoints. Take our one native Superior Court judge, Judge Madsen, who's at Kodiak. He has visited places and sort of carrying the flag to places that no Superior Court judge, no symbol, tangible evidence of the court system has ever visited. And my preference is that this is necessary, that if we're going to bring some comprehension of this Anglo-American legal system that's superimposed on different cultures, as judges, we've got to educate, and part of the judicial duty is to going out there, whether there's one or two cases, if the whole town can turn out for the trial, I say that's on the plus side. And he should travel to communities he's never been to. And this is happening in the Dillingham, Lower Aleutian area.
May I? David? You know, I don't disagree with what you say. It may have sounded so a while ago, but I think it's important that the judges do get them. I don't think it's important necessary that we have the judges scattered. And I think that maybe we've gone about far enough in that respect now. Certainly, if we're going to have a Superior Court judge here, a Superior Court judge there, there's no need of a magistrate and a district judge as well.
All right. I'd like to make a comment from the point of view of a practicing lawyer on the placing of Supreme Court justices in Fairbanks and in Juneau, even though most of the appeals are in Anchorage. Even though it may appear that most of the judicial business is in Anchorage because of the number of appeals, I believe that for many very substantial periods of time, the Fairbanks judges have actually tried more cases than the Anchorage judges, even though it was three judges compared to eight. And there are a lot of people in Fairbanks and a lot of controversy in Fairbanks. Now, one thing that happens sometimes in the trial of a hotly contested case is that the party seeks some interlocutory relief during the course of the trial, or else relief immediately after the trial, not in the form of an appeal, for which they need the Supreme Court. Now, where the litigants are big and wealthy, they can afford to fly their lawyers down to Anchorage to seek some sort of immediate relief, an expedited petition for review or stay or some such thing. But unless the litigants are very big, they just can't afford that. And if we don't have Supreme Court justices in these two other major communities of the state, where there are a lot of judges doing a lot of business, it means that the only people who can effectively use the Supreme Court for interlocutory review are very big and wealthy litigants and litigants in Anchorage. So although there's a lot to be said in terms of the travel expense and also the hardship of travel on the Fairbanks and Juneau Supreme Court justices, there's also some value to litigants of moderate means in having justices available and present in Fairbanks and Juneau.
Vance, Justice, how often have you had to deal with those?
All right. I'd like to hear from Hipler and Ashenbrenner, but I'll just make one comment. Now, you got your text of this judiciary article, which is a model, and now we're just talking about functional problems under a beautiful theoretical article. And my experience is that, of course, there's values. Since this tight little judiciary article is spread over a vast geographical area and vast cultural differences. And one of the values you give up by pulling all your judges or justices into a central location is familiarity with the different problems in the different sections of the state. That's a very definite value that you want to lose, as well as intimate contact with the members of the bar getting to know, and the community getting to know their problems. Functionally, Millard, it's a very rare occasion. If I went back and said, how many times a year do I get something that needs my immediate attention as a single judge in Fairbanks compared to the workload that I process, it would maybe be 2 out of 5,000 items over the year. That it's so small that I think I'm arguing against my own position because I don't like Anchorage and I like the way of life I have here. But I can hop on the plane, a 40-minute flight, and save the litigants all the money if the interlocutory relief is filed here, and come up 10 times a year. Maybe.
You'd be in favor of leaving the clerk's office here.
Oh sure, but. I say, without the political considerations and others, I think functionally, we waste an incredible amount of time being separated geographically.
I'd like to go on now to Peter Ashenbrenner, who was not present during the bar fight and doesn't sit in the Alaska court system, so he can have a somewhat different perspective on the theory of the Constitution and the theory of the judiciary article.
Thank you. Andy, I'd just like to address my comments to one point. The Article 4, the judiciary article, created three institutions, the Supreme Court, the Superior Court, and the Judicial Council. And we've heard a discussion about all of the functions of those, except for one small function of the Judicial Council. One of the things that happens when you write a constitution and you create institutions, it means you create a body, something like the Judicial Council or the Supreme Court, is you hope that it will grow with the times and it will meet challenges that come up that nobody thought about in 1956. And one of the problems that's developed, and it's a very serious problem if you read your mail recently, is the problem of the retention election. And it's really very simple. You're going to get a voter's pamphlet if you're registered to vote, and it will try to give you some information about the judges who are up for retention. Chief Justice Boutcheever is up, a number of Superior Court judges are up. You'll read about the material on all of those judges, even though they're in Anchorage, for example, and they won't really be on your ballot. That's because it's a statewide pamphlet. The Superior Court judges and the District Court judges up in this area, you'll get a chance to vote on. You'll get a chance to vote on the retention of Chief Justice Boutcheever. When you read that pamphlet, I think you're going to be disappointed. You're going to say to yourself, this really doesn't help me know those judges any better than I do now. On the other hand, you'll probably be happy to know that that's probably the first time that a statewide body, that's the Judicial Council, is giving you any information at all. And I'd just like to make a couple of comments about that, because more and more we're hearing a sort of undercurrent of frustration. Why should judges have to be lawyers? That tie between lawyers and judges is coming under scrutiny. Maybe it's because of Watergate, although I think in Watergate the judges came out better than anyone else. But certainly made us more aware that lawyers perhaps are not as sacrosanct as they have been. Perhaps we ought to look at their function a little bit more carefully. I think the real problem is that judges don't run for office in the first place, so they don't make any promises. And then when you see them on the ballot, you don't have the opportunity to say to yourself, well, this judge promised that he would handle so many cases, or he would be really very courteous to people, or he would sentence everyone to death, or something like that. And you don't have the opportunity to compare his record with his promises. He didn't make any promises to get on the bench in the first place. And then when you read that, when you see what the Judicial Council has done in giving you some recommendations and saying some things about these judges, they don't create any issues either. They say things like, all the judges and all the other lawyers think this fellow is just fine, or he's good, or he's excellent. And that still doesn't really give you any help. And they've recommended, unless I'm incorrect, that all of the judges who are up for election be retained. So they're...
I think with one exception.
There's one exception that they voted on. All right. In any event, for the majority of the judges, if there's a yes recommendation, again, that doesn't create any issues. And I think that one of the things that we really might discuss, because this is something that is a problem that's developed in the 20 years since the Constitution, and I think it's probably going to be a really developing issue in the next 20 years, is what are we going to do? How are we going to inform the populace about the retention election? What do you want to know about judges? And in many ways, I'm very pessimistic about that. I don't think people ultimately are really going to want to know very much about judges. I think they'll want to read the newspaper and see if somebody was let out on bail or somebody got a high sentence. I think that's probably just about all they really want to know. It's certainly proved by what Judge Davis said, that they're not breaking down the doors of the courthouse to see civil cases or even see the average criminal case in process. They want to hear about the end of it. They don't want to see what's going on in the middle, which is where you see what the judge does. And then the other point that I'd like to throw out, maybe somebody have a question about this, is what are we going to do about the pressure on the court system, this sort of concern that lawyers have too much of a role in the court system. There's perhaps too much of a privileged class. Is there anything that can be done about that? I'm not suggesting a program of education or public relations on the part of lawyers. I'd just like to hear what the concerns are.
One of the most problematic areas in Alaska has been provision of some sort of dispute resolution mechanisms to the rural areas because of cultural differences and because of expense and all the problems that arise. And, Art Hippler has done considerable work in this area, and I wonder if you could comment on it, Art.
Okay, I will. I was thinking of doing that in context of a somewhat larger overview. Rather than trying to focus on any particular aspect of Article 4 of the Constitution, I think we might keep in mind what it is that the framers inevitably had to have in mind that they weren't making explicit, but was implicit in their operation. And I hope, since we have two delegates here, that they'll correct me if that's so. They inevitably had to assume that the extension of certain kinds of services was going to be essentially, if nothing more than that, essentially a budgetary problem, that eventually one would get certain kinds of services into the bush, that the initial operation of most things was going to be constrained by budget, and that there was some assumption about, if not cultural homogeneity, certainly a general sense of a feeling that most people in the state of Alaska were able to respond reasonably well to whatever might occur to them. The reason that I can be sure in my mind that this is so is because I've talked to a number of delegates, and my impressions of what they were saying when they were talking to me is that this is about how people felt. They were aware of cultural differences and so forth, but they didn't take that too much into account and they most assuredly did not consider these in any negative sense. Justice Rabinowitz alluded to two primary problems that are faced by the administration of justice in the state of Alaska, especially in the bush areas, and those two are actually the problems. The first one is logistics. It's just very, very expensive to get out anywhere with anything. The second is, of course, the quality of the population which is being administered to, and that we'll get into later. A brief overview about what happened might be useful. Prior to statehood, in fact, immediately after the purchase of Alaska from the Russians, American law began to be felt in Alaska in the Eskimo and Indian areas for the first time. Prior to that, it's interesting to know what had happened. What had people done to try to maintain some degree of social cohesion and order in their communities? In reality, they'd done very little. And I'd like to repeat this again and make it very clear, at the cost of being misunderstood, I think it has to be very clearly stated that especially in Eskimo areas of the state of Alaska, there was nothing remotely resembling an adjudicative process to take care of personal disputes, period. Personal disputes were solved on the basis of who was strongest or who could mobilize the largest number of friends. There was no such thing as a halcyonic, Rousseauian, happy bunch of primitives sitting around the fire being very nice and comfortable with each other. That just wasn't so. These were very uncomfortable societies to live in at that time. They were endemic with violence, they were endemic with murder, they were endemic with suicide, and they were most uncomfortable places to live. And I'm going to stress this because I think it's extremely important in terms of at least one aspect of the whole of the administration of justice in Alaska. I think most people are generally agreed it is an excellent court system, and it does have deficiencies and tends to break down when dealing with the rural population. But I'm going to try to point out that a substantial part of that breakdown is not the fault of the court system. In such communities, as I'm trying to indicate, prior to contact, oftentimes people would cast an offense in non-offensive terms so that they didn't have to take offense. If a man took somebody else's canoe, or his wife, or his dog, there's a strong tendency to look on it as borrowing, because if you could say, Joe is borrowing my canoe, then you don't have to go out and fight him. And especially if he's stronger than you or bigger than you, it's wise to be able to cast it in those terms. And in fact, this is what was done. I'm trying to present you with a picture of essential social anarchy. I know this is not the normal picture that's presented, and that the normal picture is presented a great deal more Rousseauian, and I think a great deal more naive. But the realities were very Hobbesian, that life in such communities was short, brutal, and nasty. And the oldest Eskimos that we have had any ability to contact, and the earliest records that we have about any initial contact up here, are relatively similar in their accounts. That apparently the coming of United States law was an extraordinarily beneficial thing to such communities. Immediately upon the impact of the U.S. Marshal, or on the Coast Guard Cutter Bear, or whatever kind of, whatever else was impressing U.S. law on the local communities, communities were provided for the first time in their history with a capacity of actually settling local disputes without murderous feuding. That meant that people were able to get together in groups under the aegis of an outside absolute authority which could not be challenged and get rid of local murderers by simply reporting to the captain of the Coast Guard Cutter Bear that so-and-so has been killing people and we don't like him. At that point, he'd be removed, or the marshal would be removed. I think you have to keep in mind, at the risk of being boring, and repetitious, that anything remotely resembling organized legal systems or even unorganized legal systems did not exist in such communities. The coming of U.S. law was the very first kind of such thing. The village council, the Eskimo village council, does not predate white contact. Now, at this point, what happened was that people assumed in the justice system as it existed prior to statehood and to some extent after statehood that it would be just as well to allow people to handle their own problems in such communities. Now, the basis for this assumption was both sophisticated in some cases and naive in others. It was sophisticated in the extent of realizing it's very difficult to control situations thousands of miles away, and it is very difficult to understand what's going on in a community where you come in dropping it out of the sky and try to figure out what's happened overnight and everybody else there knows and has always known. These are more sophisticated assumptions about what happened in the village. From a more naive and perhaps a great deal less benign level, some people felt it was just as well to let Eskimos take care of themselves because they were of an essentially racist attitude towards Eskimos, an assumption that Eskimos were very inferior people and should be just allowed to go their own way anyway. The shift, the major shift that occurred in the administration of justice in the bush after the initiation of the village councils, which were permitted by the courts to function in a kind of quasi-judicial fashion, the major shift that occurred after that was the attempt to actually introduce a formal legal officer, ordinarily in the form of a magistrate. Now, the introduction of magistrates was almost an unmixed disaster for a couple of reasons. Where village councils had been able to operate effectively together to handle local problems because they operated in a non-confrontational way, a magistrate was forced as a single individual to look as though he were making responsible decisions over other people's lives without being able to meld that decision into some kind of a group discussion so that nobody could take the blame for what was going on. So that in a particular village, a good representative village that had been, say, handling old 200 village problems of very minuscule to very substantial over a period of years, 200 a year, as soon as a magistrate was appointed, you note that the village council is no longer handling any problems. Is the magistrate handling these 200? No, he's handling one, two, three. Are the 197 disappearing? No. It's just that nobody's in charge at all at that point. Nobody's doing anything. It was out of that that we suggested the possibility of initiating such things as conciliation boards in some such villages. A conciliation board really being simply a legal device acceptable under the Alaskan legal system that allows a person who has been injured in some way by another and who would have a civil remedy available to him to compromise that problem outside of court and then get that compromise accepted by the local judicial officer, in this case a magistrate. This, of course, is one way of picking up the slack of all of the other kinds of local revenue minor problems that many people don't want to bring to a magistrate because it seems too excessive, and also because they don't want a single individual making a decision for them, and because they're very uncomfortable, as is the magistrate, with the